Welcome to NSPCC Learning, a series of podcasts that cover a range of child protection issues to hopefully inform, create debate, and tell you all about the work we do to keep children safe. At the heart of every podcast is the child's voice and how what they tell us informs the work we do.
Hi, thanks for downloading this NSPCC Learning podcast. What you're about to listen to focuses on our Child Trafficking Advice Centre, or CTAC for short, the NSPCC's multidisciplinary team who provide free advice, guidance and training to professionals who are concerned that a child or young person has been or is about to be trafficked into or out of the UK. In this episode, we're given an overview of CTAC's work from the perspective of some of the team's social workers. I spoke to Mandy, Martina, Charlotte and Sylvia, who told me why CTAC was established in 2007, why children and young people are trafficked and exploited, and ways in which they're exploited. We discussed the vulnerabilities of the children and young people and the tricks the traffickers employ in order to control and isolate. The team also talked about what to consider if you suspect a child might have been trafficked and how they act as a support network for professionals. Finally, we hear about the child's voice and the part this plays in shaping the essential service CTAC provides. I began by asking Mandy to give me an overview of CTAC's remit.
Our remit is to raise awareness, advise and influence professionals. We were set up 11 years ago following a consultation that was carried out by the Home Office with professionals across the United Kingdom, and they all said they wanted somewhere to call. So people can call or they can email, or we even would meet face to face if that's what people require. And our role is to give advice and influence from a social work position, obviously other people in the team, police, as well as immigration. So, and we do that in a range of ways. So we would do it via, let's say, information on the internet. We have leaflets that we've designed according to what professional we're working with. We have also leaflets for young people. So because we're an audience, a service just for professionals, it makes it a bit tricky because we all come from practice of doing direct work with children. So we don't want to kind of lose that, you know, children having a voice in what we're doing. So we do have a young people's participation group, and they are young people who have been trafficked. So they get their role again is to help us to give advice and influence professionals. They will also do other things to raise awareness and influence, and that would be maybe doing things such as there's an art exhibition, they've designed leaflets, they deliver training with us. So we do it in a range of ways to get the message out, basically, right, that child trafficking is child abuse.
Absolutely. It's good to hear that obviously the child's voice is absolutely the centre of everything that doing, which is fantastic. Can you give us an indication about the prevalence of child trafficking?
I think it's like anything, isn't it? The more you kind of start focusing on it, the more you see.
Yeah.
So, you know, like many years ago, people were saying, oh, it's not that many cases, maybe 300 cases in England. I remember when we first started off. But then the more you start delivering training, the more you start getting people to understand, look at these, you could look out for these signs, or these particular children are vulnerable, then people start noticing more. So there's been figures that are absolutely millions and billions, or there's figures that are really tiny. So it depends whose research you want to read or what journal. But for us, we only deal with, let's say, children that have been trafficked across borders.
Right.
And we can only talk about the cases we have dealt with, and that has been, you know, about 2,500 children now.
Okay. And in the 11 years that CTAC has been in operation, has that remained pretty steady, or is it ebbed and flowed?
It does go up and down. Different parts of the year, it definitely sort of, what that's about, do not know. It's not always to do with there are more children being trafficked, it's more to do with generally the professionals identifying.
Okay. And I think we find that as well when we're delivering training. At the start of training, we ask everyone if they know about child trafficking of the cases, and everyone says no, generally, or there'll be one person. And then by the end of it, they're all thinking about the cases that they have, and they're like, actually, I think this might be a child trafficking case, but I didn't identify it until after the training. So we see that, I think, a lot as well in the training.
So it could be that it's maybe underreported in a sense because people don't recognise the
signs of indicators. Yeah, it's not something that's rolled out. Like for us when we were in university, it wasn't something that was covered. So it's not something that you're trained in coming out into social work. And I think even depending on what local authority you're working in, how much training or time you even have to attend training. So if they do have the time to identify it as well, or even have time to see the podcasts that are out there and listen in and understanding more about it.
I was just thinking about, for me personally, I was working as a social worker in London, and I was in an assessment team doing initial assessments, and I didn't know what child trafficking was. I had a case of a girl that was trafficked, and it wasn't until a senior member of staff said to me, "Oh, why don't you contact the NSPCC Child Trafficking Advice Centre," that I actually understood what trafficking was, what I needed to do, what the procedures were, because it was a whole other world that no one had taught me about in my, you know, years of practice before that point. And so that's how I found out about the service as well. And before that, I didn't have any of that knowledge.
I mean, so if you don't, it's like that known unknowns. If you don't know what you're looking for, you don't know whether it's out there.
Well, but I also, I also think that, you know, even after you do notice the risk indicators, what do you do after that? Who do you go to? How do you, what are the procedures to respond to a trafficked child?
So we get a lot of social workers that will call us being like, a trafficking case, I don't know what to do, how do I deal with this? And we quite clearly explain to them it's just the same as you would deal with any child protection issue. Just because it's for a national child, it doesn't mean that's any different. You'd still go through normal procedures. The only really additional thing would be the NRM, which is the National Referral Mechanism, to make sure that they are identified as a victim of trafficking.
And also for our national children, there's always an immigration issue.
Yeah.
You know, so that gets a bit, makes things a bit complicated.
Yeah.
I think going back a bit, I think what makes it difficult for people to identify children that have been trafficked is that we haven't got a definition of it. So we have categories of abuse in the United Kingdom, which is, you know, obviously sexual, neglect, emotional, physical. And I remember historically that sexual was nothing to do with the internet, was nothing to do with sexual exploitation. So I've seen that definition develop over the years.
Yeah.
And I think until trafficking is actually put into a definition for social workers, will it actually kind of, it needs to stem right from our, you know, practice and procedures and definitions to actually kind of give it the leverage that it needs. You know, it's like we think of like forced marriage or female genital mutilation. They weren't things that people thought, oh, these are forms of abuse years ago. And it's often put into the migration debate.
Yeah.
This is the problem we see. Or it's merged with adults. So we're forever as a team trying to pull it back and actually say, no, this is child abuse. You know, this is to do with safeguarding children, you know, all that sort of stuff, because often a lot of the forums that we are in are around modern slavery per se, and it will have adults, more adult services, and it is usually embedded in immigration.
I think as well, like smuggling and trafficking is always one thing that comes up time after time again about that getting
confused,
mixed up between the two,
So explain the nuances between the two.
I don't know, sometimes we're a bit...
So child trafficking is a movement of a child for the purpose of exploitation.
Right.
And let's just simplify that.
And they can't give consent.
Yeah.
So even though they could say, yeah, I want to go, you know, like my 17 years old, yeah, I want to go, it doesn't mean you can't give informed consent.
Yeah.
Smuggling is much more about organising something. An adult will be organising something with somebody else. It's a totally different, it's an adult activity. It's not a child being, so a child could be starting off smuggled, but then they end up being exploited or abused on the way.
Okay.
So, but it's got nothing to do with children. You know, smuggling is an adult thing that is much more organised. But it doesn't mean to say, you know, it does mean to say, sorry, that children that are being smuggled are extremely vulnerable and exposed and generally end up being abused or trafficked on the way.
Yeah. Sorry, that's something that I think is really key. So with smuggling, you move from A to B, and when you get to B, the relationship should end with those people that have moved you. But just because people aren't seeing that's you know, trafficking, maybe exploitation hasn't happened, it doesn't mean that child isn't really vulnerable to being abused. And sometimes it might be that people normalise that this is normal, that children are being moved across borders. But actually, that's really risky and really dangerous. And these children are extremely vulnerable. And it is child abuse.
It may present, as smuggling because the child hasn't disclosed something. Just
yeah.
like children have to be ready to be comfortable to disclose. Sorry, Sylvia.
Mm. Yeah, I was just going to say that they could be exploited along the way while being smuggled as well. And it turns into trafficking.
Okay.
Mm.
So, can we just give us some explanation about why children are trafficked? Big question, I know.
The list is pretty long.
Endless, it's adult gain, really, at the end of the day.
I think it's just, you know, traffickers or perpetrators seeing children as commodities, you know, making a lot of money from them. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking, you know, about this example that we often give in training of with drug trafficking, you traffic drugs once and you make money from that, and once off, that's it. But with the human, you can re-traffic them and re-abuse and re-exploit them over and over again, and you get a lot of money from that.
I think from the young people we've also worked with, they've often said to try and bring the young person's voice to this. This is not particularly my view, but young people would say, it wouldn't matter what has changed, I would still do it again. You know, because the situation I was in back in my country, you know, didn't have no parents, war torn, no money. It's going to be abused there anyway, so I might as well be abused here. Does that make sense? So some children have said that. If somebody's offering you a better opportunity, you think actually you're going with the adult because an adult has more wisdom, you think, and you're maybe coming from a community where you actually have a lot of respect for your elders, so you're going to actually believe everything and you're going to go and you're looking forward to it. All the young people we've worked with have said, really looking forward to it, you know, because we've heard that, you know, UK's paved with gold. Yeah. So they're going to present at borders and ports, not looking distressed, or right, some, and they might have been being given new clothes to make them, to groom them, you know, new head, you know, all promises, sorts of stuff. Yeah. So to bring a position on some young people, they would actually say they would still sooner be, because they knew they would probably die and be abused there or starve. Or so there's lots and lots of reasons. That was just one.
I suppose from the other angle is that in the UK there are places that are willing to exploit children. So there are people that are sexually exploiting children. There's adults in this country that are doing that. There's adults that are benefiting from the labour exploitation of children. Yeah. It could be, you know, they're making your Chinese takeaway behind the closed door. You don't
they're
know
doing
that.
Your nails.
They're
the
doing
nail
your nails.
Well, it's interesting. It was a comment I chatted to you a couple of weeks ago, Mandy, and it's a comment that you made about nail bars, people checking nail bars, where their children are being exposed, trafficked and exposed there. It never entered my mind.
I think it's such a common thing, and if anything, growing trend, definitely in the UK, that more and more people are getting their nails done, and then you see more and more nail art popping up, and it's always with Vietnamese communities that are running them.
Which is great business, but if you're a child, you're meant to be at school, you're not meant to be being exploited. The other big thing we used to have before that, we have a lot of children now exploited for criminal activities. So historically, back in the day, predominantly it was sexual, and I'm not saying sexual doesn't happen, and we know that for a lot of children they may be exploited in two or three ways, not just ever usually one. But then we see a lot of rise in children being used for criminal activities. Predominantly that was for cultivating cannabis. And wherever we went across the UK, or even in Vietnam doing work there, people go, no, and it's like, well, actually it's true. And like Charlotte's saying, it's actually because people want it.
Yeah.
So there was a documentary on television a couple of years ago that we actually grow, I think it was some huge figure, like 90-odd% of our own cannabis now.
Yeah.
And when you think back in the day, we used to import it. And that means it's not, you know, we, when I say we, not us, it's just children actually locked in houses and in establishments to cultivate cannabis.
Yeah.
And they were ending up in prison because they would be the person at site when the police turn up because they can detect it from the heat and da-da-da-da-da. So, yeah, huge amount of cannabis now being grown by Vietnamese children. And even that in itself, you just think, what is all that about? Why are we bringing children? Because somebody's organising that. You need interpreters, you need someone to sort out the rent. So it's all British, you know, involved in this. Because people always think, oh, it's over there, and it's actually, no, it's somebody here that actually wants it and is benefiting from it. Why would it be children from Vietnam when, I always use the expression, you know, like, loads of kids I know in the East End might be poor or would want, do you know what I mean? But it's to
the vulnerability of them.
Yeah, it's going back to the historical sort of migration patterns and things like that.
I was going to say about the vulnerability of them not knowing the systems in the UK. They don't speak the language. They're completely isolated.
Yeah.
They only have these adults who are exploiting them.
That's their only network.
They don't know. They're scared to do anything because they've made so many threats against them or their family as well. So that control that they have, manipulation, I think, is another huge thing around their vulnerability.
I mean, to the extent,
exploitation, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sexual exploitation.
To the extent we've had young people refer to us, and when they've been found in an exploitative situation, they don't know which country they're in.
Yeah.
So they're so controlled, so kept inside, and like Martina said, have no access to any services whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we expect them to be able to go to a police officer if they don't even know that they're in the UK?
Sure, and what one
they
looks like.
Trust the police.
Yeah. Like in Vietnam, they have all different uniforms. They won't know who to turn to.
And, you know, government systems are quite different in different countries. So, you know, they may not be aware that they can actually go to the police here. I mean, the police back in their home countries could be corrupt or could be quite different. So it's again that layer of another layer of fear and, you know, stopping them from going for help.
And just coming back to the types of exploitation, and I know we spoke about nail bars, the other thing I think is good for people listening to consider, that's not just one type of exploitation as well. So if it's working in a nail bar during the day and that'd be labour, then at night time sometimes it'll be sexual exploitation or criminal exploitation as well. So it comes back to what Sylvia said, is that trafficker is going to make as much money and profit out of that child as possible. So I think that's good for listeners to consider, that it's never just one. And when you see them or you come across a child who has been trafficked, don't think it's just what has happened to them. There's probably other things that have gone on. They might not be ready to disclose that as well.
So it's what you said before then, Silver, that the child is a commodity. And actually whatever you can get out of that commodity, you're going to
So it's kind of thinking in the mind of a trafficker, I think, sometimes about how what the child might have experienced as well.
Sometimes we talk about the tricks of the trafficker.
Right.
So tricks of the trafficker might be how that child is controlled. So that could be through misusing and abusing cultural values, or it could be misusing religion to try and control a young person to think that they have no choice but to be in that situation. Sometimes it could be that young person feels like they owe money and they have no other option but to do these exploitative things. Sometimes
family debts, isn't it?
Just very simply grooming. We always talk about grooming with sexual exploitation of children, but lots of trafficked children are groomed, and when they're found, it may not be that trafficked child says, "Yes, I am a victim." It could be that actually they think that the trafficker is doing what's best for them, and they've been groomed to believe that that person loves them or cares for them or has their best interests at heart. So it's never as simple as being recovered and saying, "I am a victim, please help me."
And I think, as Mandy said earlier, they might be having a slightly better life in the UK here than they maybe did experience there. So they're like, "Don't send me back to wherever I came from. They're kind of abusing me here, but no, I don't want to go back to where I was," as well. So they might not want to be identified as a victim.
And it's the hope, isn't it? I mean, a lot of the young people are told, actually, "We're going to try and get you into school," or "We're going to try," so they kind of keep being in that abusive situation, still hoping that it's going to happen.
Yeah. That was what I was going to ask, actually. How isolated are these children? So I take it they don't have school places, and they don't...
No.
Not all. I'd say a lot of them don't. But it's very hard to say no child is going to be in school, because we have dealt with children who have been in school. Their families might be exploiting them for something like benefits. Okay. Not their families, sorry. Their actual people.
Yeah,
the people think they're their families. So the child might have come, the family back home might have said, "Oh, you're going to go with Auntie Diddly Diddly, you're going to have education, you're going to have a better life, and you might have to do some jobs in the house or something like that." So they might do all that, and they're thinking, "Actually, I'm going to be going to school soon."
But I think it's also important to acknowledge that family members can also traffic their own children.
Right.
And we have seen, you know, maternal or paternal aunties or uncles traffic a child with a disability for benefit fraud.
We've seen parents being heavily involved in trafficking.
But generally, I'd say this, if I was to make a generalisation, I don't know what you would think, I'd say there's more people that are not parents. That doesn't mean to say that's what, you know, somebody's trying to say. It's just like anyone's going to abuse that child.
Sure.
Can we talk about the advice area side of things that CTAP does? So if there are social workers listening here, what kind of calls do you get? What kind of inquiries? What advice? I know this is going to be huge, but it can make it like, what should social workers be looking for? What would raise an alarm? What concerns? You guys know what are being asked. So can we move the discussion onto the advice side of things?
I think that social workers should always be inquisitive when it comes to who children are with, and not making short assumptions that people are family. If there are concerns that they're not family, they should be wary to not suddenly... be so sure that this is mum, this is dad, because maybe it's not. And we have had many a case where there has been an assumption that this is mum, this is dad, but actually it's turned out that those are the people exploiting the children and they are not related at all.
I think one of the big benefits for having this advice line is social workers just calling and having a chat about it, because when you're in the social work field, you're so overwhelmed with the amount of cases you have going on, everyone's screaming and shouting at you, and like, you need to get someone, your report's done. Having someone to kind of talk to on the phone and actually support you as well, and like, following up inquiries and everything like that. I think that's the biggest benefit to our team to offer to social workers, because you kind of take a bit of weight off them, being like, I'll put together, this is what it is, this is trafficking, this is the legislation, and I'll back up your argument for you, and kind of offering that advice to them. I think that really supports and they appreciate that quite a lot. So sometimes it is just a call to be like, I don't know if this is trafficking, but I just want to speak to someone about it.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily just social workers. We get foster carers, we get solicitors, police, any professions, different professions will call us up as well.
We've also had social workers call us because they know that we are a multi-agency team.
Yeah.
So they've been able to utilise our Home Office colleagues to get information from just one central database system. So we know that local authorities don't have that one system all across the UK, but the Home Office does. So what usually happens is, if we do have enough details of that child, we can always refer it to our Home Office colleagues, who can then do a Home Office check, and then that information can sometimes be very valuable for the social worker in safeguarding that trafficked child.
Obviously this podcast is specifically from a social work perspective, but we do have a National Crime Agency, we do have Home Office within the team,
because they do have safeguarding duties now and responsibilities they never used to have before. So we can come back to that afterwards, but that's why we have them in the team, because they do have responsibilities now, so which was a good thing for us. So even though they may be protecting our borders or preventing people to come, they actually do have responsibilities to safeguard children. They take that quite seriously, actually, in working with other agencies.
Yeah.
I think the advice, going back to that question around, it could be like saying giving it guidance, given whether it be legislation, what procedures they should follow, or like say if you're dealing with a foreign national child, it may be dealing with the embassies. If it's a European child, again, it kind of is different. So everything is a different advice according to what it would be. But obviously what we're doing is looking at it from a social worker and actually saying, but this is lots of concerns here for this child, and it could be that actually it needs a child protection response according to what country it is in the United Kingdom, is about what advice they need to be going. But it is, if it's a child protection response, then it's ABCD, and if it's a safeguarding, then try to get more information about your assessment and stuff, and then what agencies you need to be working with to be able to kind of work together. And that's when CTAC can actually say, if you need me, I'll even come along.
Great.
So again, it could be, that somebody's got all the information, thanks for all the guidance you forward to them. A lot of also like social workers might need to challenge their bosses. And I think that's something I've seen a more bit of trend in recent years, that actually they might feel concerned about something, but their management is actually saying, no, send them back or whatever, or not going to give services. Yeah.
For legal planning meetings, it's a big one to try and reach the threshold, and I think that's something we kind of work on quite a lot, of like building all the evidence to say this should meet the threshold for getting an ICO, which is your interim care order, for a child or young person. And then the other thing that we do, or we have done as well, is supporting letters for court as well. So we kind of give an expert report to kind of support going for an ICO as well, or getting a full care order to protect that child.
Or even those reports can be for the immigration of that child as well, to get them recognised as a child that's trafficked.
Well.
And the NRM, use my mentioning before.
So I think as well, advice for social workers that's really important is, when working with these children, foreign national children who might have been trafficked, is don't make any assumptions. So don't assume that they understand anything about the systems around them, and don't assume that they trust anything about the systems around them. And you can't go into that situation and expect that a child is going to trust you just because you say you're a social worker.
Okay.
So you need to build that trust with the young person. And part of doing that is actually giving them the information so that they're empowered, or as empowered as they can be, to understand that you should be able to trust the police in this country, because their job here is to, enforce the law, make sure that they're there for you if something goes wrong. You can call 999. By giving them that information, it really helps. And we have leaflets that explain in child-friendly language what child trafficking is, what exploitation is, because these words mean nothing to children.
True.
They're just these fancy professional terms. So actually explaining it to them in language that they understand is really important. But also to make sure that you're treating each child as an individual. So social workers might be seeing many Roma children, for example, being trafficked, and they might think, okay, it's a Roma child, so they will be believing this, this and this, or this is how they're going to act, or this is what's going to happen. But everyone's an individual, and that child is an individual, and they'll have individual experiences. So acknowledging that and making sure that you actually work with that child to not make assumptions about their background, empowering them with knowledge, and trying to work to get them into a position where they can trust the people around them.
To add on to that, and like empowering them with knowledge and giving the right information, making sure that, I don't know if you've already mentioned it, that they know that foster care is free and they don't have to pay for it here, because they'll get given clothes and food. and they're going to think, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to repay this debt. Like, if a trafficker did this to me, I'd have to repay him, or I'd have to do something. So they're going to feel that pressure. So even explaining simple things like that to them. Because the other thing that we come across a lot in this job is the risk of them going missing. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a high risk of definitely Vietnamese children that we would see gone missing. Mm-hmm. So when that social worker meets that child, there's so much that they have to do to try and build that relationship to reduce the risk of them going missing.
When we say missing, yeah. we often think in our head of a child that is running away because it's fun or they want yeah. to be naughty. But that's not the case. These children are being groomed, controlled yeah. and re-trafficked. Mm-hmm. They're not choosing to leave. They have no choice. They yeah. feel like they don't have that choice. So it's a really high-risk situation yeah. that they're in. And it's not as simple as many of the kind of classic missing cases you might come across, because you know if that child's already been exploited and trafficked, then they're very vulnerable to being re-trafficked again.
How you reassure them that they're going to be safe in that placement and the trafficker doesn't know where they are, or that's going to find them, or they don't need to pay, things like that.
And so how do you do that? I mean, I know, you know, it's not just one conversation and yeah. you know, magically these children realise. It's, how do you navigate that?
Yeah, it can be quite difficult as well, because when you're taking a child into care, it's all very high pressure. It's a lot of things you have to do within that time. And I think it's key taking time to sit down yeah. and explain it to that child or young person.
I think it's sort of like working with any other child who's been through abuse, yeah. you know, building that trust and acknowledging that, yes, it will take some time, because it, you know, it has taken a while for that child to trust their trafficker. So what difference would that make? You know, us as professionals need to sort of use our own skills to build that trust with the child and work from there.
Yeah.
It's also the placement, appropriate placement yeah. for that child. I mean, we've had children that been put in bed and breakfasts,
yeah.
which is totally inappropriate. We've had children that have been put in accommodation down the road from the brothel they've just been picked up in. I mean, mm. you know, common sense would tell you, actually, you've got yeah. to put a bit of planning into it, and those yeah. who are looking after that child, wherever the placement is, needs to also be given enough information about how to safeguard that child. Mm. It could, you know, be much more vigilant. You know, a child may not be having access to internet or something, so it depends on every child's, you know, like Charlotte said, every case, every child's got their own needs, and it's about really thinking much wider than just the care of that child. It is much more about thinking about all the adults that could be abusing them, because this is organised crime,
yeah,
and somebody's going to want that child from somewhere, so you've actually got to think of it, you've got to step back from it a bit and not get so focused on just the child. You've actually got to think about the wider network of it all, whether it's the professionals you need to utilise or the organised criminals or people who actually want to do more to that child. So
we do have leaflets as well in local languages as well for young people to understand, so they can take that leaflet themselves. If after explaining them, they still have something in their own language that they can hold on to and keep that with, so they can read through that information.
And we also have kind of tick box checklists of information to minimise the risk of children going missing.
Yeah.
So things that are very simple, like registering an Oyster card so you could see the child's journey in the future,
yeah.
not letting a child have extreme amounts of cash on them. Mm. We've had children that social workers called up and they've had thousands of pounds of cash on them, and that's not been questioned.
Mm.
But obviously that makes a child very vulnerable, having that amount of money on them. So sometimes it's the little practical things. If they're in a foster placement, don't put them in the bedroom next to the door that actually leads to outside.
Yeah.
You know, those types of things. They're small, but they could make a difference.
Yes. Yeah. We mentioned a little bit earlier on the podcast that you have an advisory group of young people that have previously been trafficked.
Used to. It's not so big, it's
okay.
very minimal now.
Yeah. Can we just discuss that a little bit about how do they help inform your work?
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work?
So they do a range of things, or they have done over the years, much more creative than what we could ever be, about how can you influence. They've done voice recordings for us to work in Ghana and Nigeria, Vietnam. They've done various things. If we're actually done work in China, one of the young people come in and told us what to expect.
So they really influence your work and help give you insights
and delivering the training as well.
I did a conference with one of the young people, and she spoke in front of 500 professionals about her about the group's experiences, and it was really powerful.
And I think professionals really, like, we could talk all day about it, but hearing it from young people or just even in the DVD, that's always more powerful than anything that we would say, because it's coming straight from them and their kind of experience.
But it does take a lot of work, and I think the group is pretty gone now. We've got to reassess as a team, what are we going to do, how are we going to do it, because it isn't just, I mean, people often think, oh, we have a young people's group, they come along and they'll dribble it and they'll go, oh, goodbye, thank you. It's not like that. So you have to really, really keep in communication with them, which is the stuff I used to do before, like in the evenings and other people in the team. It may be that you go with them to challenge their social worker, their housing. I've been with them giving birth. You know, you name it. Every single thing. So you've got to be, so it's like a bit like, it's unconditional what you're giving them. But actually, the key thing and the most important thing is about what they're giving trust. But you've got to give, because they still need lots of support. They haven't got their family or support networks here. So we do end up becoming, or we have become, like, especially the young people from 18 like to 21, 22, like, you really are, might not be the only person that they can come to for references.
So many challenges.
Buying for a job.
Essays.
Exactly. So you're all the things that maybe a parent would be, you know.
Many thanks to Mandy, Martina, Charlotte and Sylvia for giving me their time to talk about the work of CTAC. For further advice or information relating to child trafficking, professionals can contact the NSPCC Child Trafficking Advice Centre on 0203 772 9513 or email ctac@nspcc.org.uk.
Thank you for listening to this NSPCC Learning podcast. If you're looking for more safeguarding and child protection training, information or resources, please visit our professionals' website at nspcc.org.uk/learning.